But as this last passage here, just on this section, says, it's not easy. Jesus said to his disciples, "Truly I tell you, it'll be hard for a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven." He doesn't just mean a big bank account. He means intellectually gifted. He means rich in many ways. Because if we're gifted a lot, we're rich in some way at whatever level of our being. As you know, I presume, as I know, it's easy to perhaps get distracted into becoming self-reliant or thinking we're managing okay, rich in health even. And sometimes we need to lose something to go back to who we really are, and who we really are is a very needy, fragile human being. And that might take us to love. It's very hard, said Jesus, for a rich man to enter the kingdom. Again, he said to you, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for someone rich to enter the kingdom of heaven. There are some funny reasons given for that. It used to be in books that are still tricking people about the eye of a needle being the inside door of a big... Don't worry about them. They're not in the right... They're anachronistic. Either Jesus is saying it's harder for a camel to go through the eye of a needle, you know, a needle they'd use for, like you do for doing bags or something. He might be saying that. It seems a bit of an ugly image to me. I have a hesitation of thinking Jesus would use... Every other image Jesus used fits nicely. So I'm about to tell you something that might... It's dangerous to be shit-changing the scriptural text, but... Camelos, with a long E, is camel. But the long E in modern Greek is pronounced E, and was for a long time. As other ones, Kyrie eleison is really Kyrie eleison, but Kyrie is an E sound. So camelos could well have been pronounced Camelos, a camel. But Camelos means, with an I in Greek, is that rope that attaches a boat to the wharf, the hawser, it's technically called, the front, the prow, I think you can, they come from the prow, don't they, and hold the boat to the moorings. It's a very attractive hypothesis, and highly likely, I think, that what Jesus said is easier to push that great big rope through a needle, and of course you can't, but you nearly can, but you can't, than it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Either way, the point is clear. When the disciples heard this, just as when they heard what Jesus said about marriage earlier, they were greatly astounded and they said, "Who can be saved?" Good question. "What can I do," said the rich young man, "to merit eternal life?" Here they say, "Well, look, who's going to be saved? It's too hard." And Jesus looked at them and said, what a lovely answer, "For human beings it's impossible." So could you all relax? Like you can't do it, so let's give up that effort. But for God, all things are possible. So God can actually save me, meaning give me his love, give me his spirit, purify my heart. He can do all those things, and he can do it to me, he can do it to you, and he wants to do it out of love. So why not let him, and why not open our hearts to God in humility and trust and listen to God, who will tell us where he wants us to do to cooperate with grace. But he doesn't want us to organise it, or to initiate it, or to set out upon it. He wants us to respond to grace. Gently, he knows best. In time, like a little toddler, we'll learn to crawl, and we'll learn to walk, and we'll learn to run, and we'll end up these wonderful energetic adults here before me. To God all things are possible. I just want to read to you, to make it brief, a short reflection on that passage. It's only brief. This is why John of the Cross sees the dark night as what he calls a sheer grace. Nobody, says John of the Cross, is able alone to empty himself of all his desires in order to reach God. You can't do it on your own. John of the Cross also warns us of those subtle possessions, even quite spiritual ones, that hold us back from journeying with Jesus. Quotation from the Ascent of Mount Carmel. They must not so rely on their sharp intellects, nor upon gifts received from God, as to believe that their attachments or appetites will not blind, darken, and cause them to grow gradually worse. I must say, when I was chaplain at the university for 10 years back in the 70s in Sydney, this was terribly apparent. Really tragic stuff, I believe. Highly intelligent people, highly trained in a very narrow area, could stand up and dismiss the mystics, religion, prayer, anything that's mysteriously valuable in our tradition, from a higher place because of their high intelligence. Sharp, narrow intelligence. It's a perfect example of what John of the Cross said there. Somehow, ability in one area produced a brittle pride that made people so blind to something that very ordinary, simple mums and dads and aunties and uncles can experience and see in nature and in people. Beautiful things that are so simple, lost to the intellectually proud. And the culture pushed people, I think, in that direction. Many didn't go in it, thank God. But it was a very sad thing to see a highly trained mind so ignorant of its limits. And of course I had to then reflect, well, what am I doing? And we can get blind to the limits, perhaps, of our mind, though life, you'd think, would teach us fairly quickly. Attachment to anything that possesses us, no matter how small, will tie us down and prevent us answering the call to eternal life, even when we desire it as much as does the man in the scene we've just read. As noted earlier, John of the Cross uses the image of a bird whose leg is tied by a strong piece of string. Or the leg of the bird is tied by the flimsiest little thread. And what he says is beautifully, he says, as long as the thread remains unbroken, the bird cannot fly. A little silk thread or a strong rope doesn't matter. Tie has to be broken. There might be some very little thing holding you back from sanctity. No more can we fly while we remain attached to anything other than God's will, no matter how insignificant it may appear. Moreover, of ourselves we need all the security we can find, and so we can't break from these possessions on our own. We need to hear the call. We need also the grace of God to untie us and set us free. Back to our text. Peter said in reply, Peter representing all of the disciples, look, he said, we've left everything and followed you. What then will we have? And Jesus said to them, truly I tell you, at the renewal of all things, when the Son of Man is seated on the throne of his glory, you who have followed me will also sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. The The Son of Man we've done before, I won't go into it again except briefly to redefine it for you. It's Jesus as identifying with all the poor, the broken, the oppressed, and as vindicated in God's judgment by God himself. That's the Son of Man. Vindicates the lover, the compassionate one, the obedient servant, the broken, poor, oppressed, crucified one. So Jesus says, if you join me in this, you will judge the 12 tribes of Israel. In other words, they'll be judged by you. That will be the standard by which the whole of Israel, 12 of them, the whole new Israel, the whole world, will be judged, will be by the qualities that you share with me as the Son of Man. Later we'll find out what they are very beautifully. I was hungry and you gave me to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me to drink. You know them well. But that's a few chapters to come. Basically, the whole world, all of us, are going to be judged by our relationship to Jesus and those who identify with him and walk with him, the saints. And he concludes, answering Peter's question, we touched on this last week, everyone who's left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother, Luke adds, or wife, brackets, or husband. So sometimes we have to leave intimate relationships to follow Jesus when they're not life-giving and when they're destructive and so on. Everyone who's left all these things, and it's hard to leave them, because of me, will receive 100-fold and will inherit eternal life. Then comes a parable which I'll read fairly quickly because it's familiar to you, and the point of it I think is really obvious, as in all Jesus' parables. He said, however, of those who follow him and receive 100-fold, many who are first will be last and the last will be first. And now he gives an example of that. So our criteria is not that of Jesus or of God. We don't see the heart. Some people whom we look at as being really wonderful people, perhaps they are. Perhaps they're only using half their gifts. So it'd be silly to be proud, wouldn't it? Or to be too overwhelmed by looking at someone we admire. They may have 10 times the gifts that we have and be living twice as well as we are. Well under the qualities that God gives them. And another person, like the widow, might be giving nothing nearly and giving all she has. So we've got to stop judging. Appreciate beauty, but let's leave judgment to God, good and bad. Many at first will be last, and the last will be first. Then he tells this story. The kingdom of heaven is like a landowner, is our translation, the Revised Standard Version, but the original is the Lord of the house, and that's a phrase that's been used of Jesus in an earlier chapter, the Lord of the house. And the house, in a way, is the church here. So Matthew is again thinking of the community. And the Lord of the house is Jesus. But, so, same phrase. When the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire labourers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the labourers for the usual day's wage, that is 1 denarius, for a day of picking fruit or harvesting, He sent them into the vineyard. He went out about 9 o'clock, or as it says, in the third hour. They measure their hour from sunrise. So in the third hour, 9 o'clock, and he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. He said to them, you can go into the vineyard and I'll pay you whatever is right. So they went. He went out again about noon and about 3 o'clock and did the same. And about 5 o'clock, only an hour to go, he went out and found others standing round, and he said to them, why are you standing here idle all day? And they said, no one has hired us. He said to them, will you go to the vineyard too? So before we come to the conclusion, there is work to be done in the vineyard. There are things we can do. We're not sitting back waiting for God to do everything. We've got to work the soil, but God plants the seed. We've got to row, but God is the one who calms the water and takes us to our destiny. We've got to do the fishing, but the catch is always a miracle from God. So here they are, going about, as you and I are, please God, working in the vineyard. When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to the manager, call the labourers and give them their pay. And when those who were hired at 5 o'clock came, each of them received a denarius, a coin, a full day's wage for 1 hour's work. Wonderful. When the first came, those who had been labouring all day, they thought they'd receive more. But each of them received the usual daily wage. And when they received it, they grumbled against the landowner, saying, these last worked only 1 hour. You've made them equal to us who've borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat. But he replied to them, friend, I'm not doing you any wrong. Didn't you agree with me for the usual daily wage? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last the same as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or are you envious because I'm generous? Please ask yourself that question. I'll ask myself. Are you envious because of God's generosity? So, says Jesus, the last will be first and the first last. So we should be nothing but delighted at a thief on a cross going straight to paradise. And if we fancy that we've lived a holy life all of our lives, that very thought indicates we haven't led a very holy life at all. The very thought indicates that. So, no, let's just be wonderfully grateful for anyone who's taken to life or relieved from a mess or brought into community, and let's just go out and just love God for being so generous to people and leave all the judgment to God and all the reward. In Matthew's community, I would imagine this has something to do with the Jewish-Gentile problem as well. You've got the Jewish Christians having some difficulty in accepting Gentiles into their community, I would think, who didn't belong to the tradition and hadn't gone to the right schools and hadn't been brought up and all that. I imagine, well, we don't only imagine it, there was some problem, and that would be one application of this parable, but we can make our own. Chapter 20. When Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside by themselves and said to them on the way, see, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priests and scribes, and they'll condemn him to death. Then they'll hand him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified, and on the third day he will be raised. I don't intend to comment on that at all, because you realise that's the third time almost those identical words have been used. One back in chapter 16, just after Peter acknowledged him as the Christ, and one in chapter 17. And now for the third time, Jesus says it. Three times means persistent. It's not just one, two, three. Threefold denial, threefold prayer in the agony, the third day. All of these expressions mean it's a persistent thing. Jesus kept saying it right to the end, and it was a constant in his teaching that he was going to suffer, but God would reveal himself to Jesus. Jesus trusted in it and would continue his journey. Just after that statement, look at this enormous contrast. We're very strange people, we're human beings, and we take a long time to learn the basic messages. The mother of the sons of Zebedee came to him with her sons. That's James and John, the two were at the Transfiguration the other day, and will be at the agony. So she came with her sons, and kneeling before Jesus, she asked a favour of him. And he said to her, what do you want? She said to him, declare that these two sons of mine will sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your kingdom. But Jesus answered, you don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink? Do you really want to be that close to me when the kingdom comes? By the way, we know that when the kingdom came, that's the crucifixion of Jesus, the two that were closest were dying on a cross. Do they actually want that? Do we want it? Do we know what we're asking for when we want to be close to him? Are you willing to drink that chalice? And they said, we are able. Lovely answer. And they were. And Jesus said to them, you will indeed drink my cup. But to sit at my right hand and my left is not mine to grant. It is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father. Here's the point that he's leading to. So that was the two of them with their mother, strangely unaware of what they were wanting. Wanting honour, perhaps. Wanting to be first. Wanting to be in a position of dignity. So when the ten heard it, they were angry with the two brothers. But Jesus called them to him and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. It will not be so among you. But whoever wishes to be great among you must be your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you must be your slave. The image of a domestic house where the slave belongs to the family, but their only possibility is to serve the others. They're not free to do anything else. They're a prisoner of love, if you like. They're a prisoner of service. They're just there to do what's needed. I can't read that without thinking of my mother with eight kids. But some might call that slavery. She didn't have a career. But isn't it a career to bring up eight kids? And she did it very beautifully. And of course, what a loving relationship she was able to have with her husband and my father and us and so on. And beauty and dignity and sanctity and adulthood all grow out of that wonderful. They also grow out of careers, isn't it? Of course, each one has to make their decision. But that it is possible, isn't it, to serve with dignity and to find one's joy and maturity in that. So that's what Jesus is saying here, in whatever way you and I have to do it, to be the servant, the diakonos, the one who does God's will appropriately and caringly, and to be the slave. That's what he wants us to be. Just as the Son of Man, this is a powerful statement, Jesus came not to be served but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Sometimes that ransom for many is misunderstood. It sounds like it might be selective, and just in case you understand that way, I'd like to clarify for you that many in Aramaic is not distinct from all. It's distinct from few. So if there were three people here and they were all doing something, you couldn't say many because it's too small. Many in Aramaic means it's not a few, it's not a small group. It could be all, but it's certainly not a small esoteric remnant group. To indicate that, I'll just give you a couple of texts. And the basis of that statement is from Isaiah chapter 53, from the last of the great servant songs. And that's where, obviously, the text is drawing on that. The righteous one, my servant, shall make many righteous. He shall bear their iniquities. Therefore I will allot him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured himself out to death and was numbered with the transgressors. yet he bore the sins of many and made intercession for the transgressors. So there's the expression, many. But let's look at Romans chapter 5, verse 18 to 19. Just as one man's trespass, that's Adam, led to the condemnation for all, so one man's act of righteousness led to justification and life for all. Next sentence. For just as by one man's disobedience the many, many, were made sinners, so by one man's obedience the many will be made righteous. The multitude, the vast multitude. All and many used in one sentence after the other, speaking about the same group. But all is a large, 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 large number. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 5, there's one mediator between God and humankind, Jesus Christ himself, a man who gave himself as a ransom for all. So the offering is to all. Will all accept it? We don't know. It's up to us. But it's offered to all, and a great multitude will. And now the last scene for this first session. This is the last scene on the journey to Jerusalem and finishes this long and rather beautiful section. As they were leaving Jericho, a large crowd followed him, and there were two blind men sitting by the side of the road. So there are two. There's one in Mark and one in Luke. Let's not worry about them. In Matthew, there are two. I think undoubtedly a Jew and a Gentile in the drama of the gospel. And they're not on the road. They're, as we often are, they're sitting on the side of the road. They're off the track. When they heard that Jesus was passing, they shouted, and the Greek is, Kyrie eleison, which I think you've heard before. And the suggestion is, very likely, that this text actually grew out of the Antiochian liturgy. Matthew takes the words of the liturgy, Kyrie eleison, and puts them in his gospel as the words of these blind community. And in a sense, every time we say the Lord have mercy or Kyrie eleison, we're meant to think of this passage. Not just as individuals are we blind, but we're blind as communities. We don't know God's will. We're not sure how to carry out the mission. We're not sure how to reconcile. We're not sure of a lot of things. So we as a community always start our Eucharist every time we come together with the words of these blind men. Lord, have mercy. Kyrie eleison. Right at the end of the journey, we are too, these people. This is the last day. We still can't see. The crowd sternly ordered them to be quiet, but they shouted even louder, Kyrie eleison, Lord, have mercy. Jesus stood still and called them, saying, what do you want me to do for you? And that could be a beautiful question in which we could end this section too. What do you want Jesus to do for you? We've journeyed all the way and we still can't see. We've listened to all those lovely stories about marriage and celibacy and children and riches and but we still can't see because we're too frightened of the cross, understandably. It haunts us and we don't want to suffer and we want to feel good. And we're scared of following Jesus for whatever reason we might be. So Jesus says, look, what do you want me to do for you? And they said to him, Lord, let our eyes